Hi, I'm Jen Sherlock, and welcome to my lifestyle podcast, Live Without a Net. The podcast showcases people who live fearlessly and have the ambition to create something. I'll showcase change makers who have decided to let go of their safety net in order to survive. So let's jump right in. Hi, I'm Jen Sherlock. Welcome to Live Without a Net. I'm with Dennis Carradin. He's the founder and CEO of the Trauma Survivors Foundation. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Jen. This is awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm so impressed with your background. I don't know where to begin, but let's start with how you started this Trauma Survivors Foundation. I know you said you had the foundation for 11 years now, but tell people what got you interested in helping trauma survivors.
Wow. So that takes me, that's a loaded question. No. What got me started, it was funny, when I got into my undergrad, I got in to be a pediatrician. I had worked with kids as a lifeguard when I was younger. Funny story, my grandmother had lied about my age. I was supposed to be legally 16 years old, and she lied when I was 14. So I started this helping profession. And I got into my undergrad and I thought, okay, well, I'll take science and medical science and all this stuff. And I met one of the coolest psychology professors known to man. If there's ever such a thing as a cool psychologist, I've been told there's not, but you know, Dr. Pat Kranz, man, she was amazing. I think she was 330 years old when I met her, and drive around campus in this little convertible Turbo Z playing like the 70s music. And it was so much fun to listen to her. And she got this weird fire ignited in me about psychology. So I had actually switched from my pre-med major and went into the world of psychology. And when I got to my master's, in my master's degree, I met two other mentors. One was a Philadelphia firefighter, former Philadelphia firefighter. He's a professor at LaSalle now. And the other was a full-time professor that kind of pushed my reach. I had been a volunteer firefighter and an EMT. I've, you know, done peer support counseling. I've done all that. But there was this emerging field, this trauma psychology. And it was amazing to me. So I started there at Temple in Philadelphia. And started working with the different police and fire departments, worked with the Philadelphia EAP, for police and fire. We're working with the Delaware crisis team, Maryland's crisis team, and started building this up at like the ripe old age of, I don't know, like 21, 22, right? You know, and so when I got into practice, you know, after graduation, I got licensed in Delaware as a clinician and wanted to start, you know, continue this work in trauma psychology. And at that point, we had started seeing the advanced uses of it, of being able to debrief first responders after shootings and mass shootings and natural disasters, and just started looking around and saying, okay, well, who could use me? And I found these international, which sounds kind of weird, but international trauma firms that could use, you know, a therapist, could use this trauma therapist to help out with, you know, after a plane crash, body recoveries and you know, after a mass shooting, you know, how to notify parents of kids' death and all that. And I thought, okay, well, this is where I'm going to start, you know, which sounds, you know, bizarre. It's like, oh, yeah, I started getting excited about all the tragedies in the world. So I did that. And one of the big things that I started making was a niche in my practice where I only see first responders and healthcare workers and very limited people. And so continued to build it and then started going internationally to tsunamis and the world disasters. I spent 3 months on the pile at 9/11, was at the Las Vegas shooting, the insurrection, you know, all these major events. But going back to the original question, sorry, you asked me what time it is and I'm telling you how to build a clock. So going back to the original question, the Trauma Survivors Foundation started because of my practice, because of what I was doing and seeing a need. So the inception 11 years ago was at the Sandy Hook massacre, the school shooting. When I was up there, One of our jobs, you know, unfortunately, one of our jobs was to help the families, you know, identify the bodies, work with the first responders, and generally just counsel people in the area. And when I did that, I was noticing certain trends. One of the biggest trends that I noticed is that we were there, you know, right at the inception, just a few hours afterwards, but people, you know, were just kind of going off on their own. They weren't really looking at follow-up or anything. And I didn't think about that until I think it was the Monday after I got there. It happened on a Friday afternoon. I'd worked throughout the weekend. And on Monday, I was called out to a different part of Connecticut, which escapes me right now. We'll just say Groton. How about that? I was called out to Groton, Connecticut. There you go, from the area, Sandy Hook area. As I was traveling there, it was probably 6:30 in the morning. It was early. I was in a business suit because I had to go out to a business where a lot of the families had worked this company. And I stopped at a Dunkin', and you know, Dunkin's up in the Northeast, you could spit and hit 25 of them, you know. And
right.
Just this random Dunkin', I stopped in Danbury, Connecticut. I walked in, and there was a girl in across the counter, one of the servers, probably 21, 22 at best, and she had just a look. I didn't think anything about it, and I asked for a large hot black coffee. You know, that's all I asked for. And all of a sudden she starts crying. And I thought, did I order wrong? Like, is there some way I have to order up, you know, like Philadelphia order cheese with, you order.
Right.
Thinking maybe it was coffee black I had to order, but
I thought it was when you put the L that it was.
Well, that was the other one. I always order. This is the dumbest thing in the world. If I do this, this is, I want a large coffee. Now, if I want a small coffee, I'll do this, but this is a large coffee. And this is what I did. And she starts crying. And the manager comes out and like gives me this death stare. Like, what did you do? And I was like, no. I said, look, I'm not a reporter. I'm a trauma therapist. I'm a trauma psychologist. And she just looks at me and she goes, oh, well, her nephew was murdered at the school. And I went, oh, dear God. You know, so
yeah,
up speaking to her about 30 minutes. And part of my job isn't correcting the problems. It's kind of bringing it down to like a normalcy. Like, your feelings are normal at this time and you're not going crazy. You're being normal. So spoke to her about 30 minutes and found out that she was underinsured. She's a college student paying for it on her own. She's working like some ridiculous amount of hours here at this Dunkin'. And I said, look, you know, did you go to any of the groups, any of the meetings that we had? And she goes, I went to one, but there was too many people and I felt really conscious about it. And I said, well, look, I have a friend up in the area. I'm going to pay for 10 sessions for you and I want you to go. And she did. She did that fantastic. She went every week to kind of resolve this. And so the idea of the Trauma Survivors Foundation came out of, like, we're there at the beginning. We're there to help normalize things. We're there to, you know, at the inception of a disaster, but we had to do something for follow-up care. So we set up a model that basically said is that, you know, folks that are involved in these type of situations could go to one of our network therapists, that we have about 2,800 of them. You can go to a network therapist for 5 sessions. And so that's how it started. There, long story, but that's kind of where it is and where it started.
It's so interested and needed. What was the worst disaster that you've witnessed, and where do you think you had the most help in it?
Wow. There's many of them. And, you know, I hate to say it, it's all a little bit different. You know, the mine goes directly to the ones involving kids. So I was called out to Oslo, Norway, after the kids were murdered on the island in the camp. And then shortly after that was Sandy Hook. So I think the worst for me personally have been with the kids. Disaster-wise, you know, just wide-scale disaster, 9/11, Hurricane Katrina was just, I had spent 4 months in the relief efforts at Hurricane Katrina, and that was intense because of the enormity to it. You know, 2,000 Americans were killed by a natural disaster, by a storm, you know, where you had, you know, over 3,000 Americans killed by terrorist acts. But for me personally, it's always the kids. It destroys that terra firma, that firm earth that basically says that all things are normal. Like, you know, a mum or pup passes away. And my career as an EMT, you know, you knew that if you went in for a CPR and there was an 88-year-old that was having a heart attack, you could kind of, even all the first responders, put that in their mind of, well, this is natural. This is the natural order of things, right? You know, people die. But when it's a child and they're murdered, it really sets you back a little bit. So, yeah, so it's, I think, enormity, 9/11, the tsunami in Indonesia, and Hurricane Katrina. But for me personally, the hardest, I think, me to deal with was going to into Oslo and Sandy Hook.
I have so many questions from that, though. So I'm sure it's so hard. Where are you, and are you just there at the end of their shift, or if they need to talk to someone? I know you said you're there identifying bodies too. Like, what's your role?
I'm the jack of all trades with this one. You know, it really depends on what the need is. You know, sometimes I know with 9/11, I was on the pile digging alongside, doing evaluations and talking to the first responders while I was digging for bodies with them. I, you know, was waist high deep in water down at Hurricane Katrina, looking through the pockets of new and old dead to get them reunited with their families. So there's like the nitty gritty. Other ones, you know, where I'm sitting in an office building waiting for people to come in and talk to me. It really depends on that need. Like, I could say our bread and butter, and I say this nicely, I say it fair. Every profession has a bread and butter. You know, you have something that is your go-to. You do it all the time. It's there. You know, you look at a police call, and their bread and butter is the mum that thinks she heard something in the backyard and it was a dog or something like that. And they know that if they get the phone call to this house, they know what's up, you know, and they kind of joke it off. Our bread and butter in the trauma field is a bank robbery. Typically, it's a note passing. Somebody scribbles something on it and they steal X amount of dollars from somebody. And so when I go in there, it's almost like this script in my head, which I always have that empathy for everybody. It's horrible. If, you know, you go through it, it's bad. It's not great. Everybody's tragedy. But in my mind, I have done so many bank robberies that I have like this little script. And I walk in, I was like, okay, well, this doesn't happen every day, and so on and so forth. And so in that need, it's just my presence sometimes, just to tell them that what they're feeling is pretty normal. And so again, it's jack of all trades. You know, I can tell a funny story. I'll tell a funny story if there is a funny story of a bank robbery. So up in Philadelphia, there was this one PNC branch that was literally robbed every 4 to 5 days. It was just ridiculous.
Where was it?
Actually right near, what's that? Third and Market, I think.
Market. Right. Oh, okay.
Fox 29 Studios,
right,
area.
Yeah.
And they have done a lot of measures in there to help clean it up. And so I literally was going up every 4 to 5 days for another one. And there was this beautiful woman in there. She was just great. She was mama. She was a hugger, and she was one of the tellers. At any time I would go up there, you know, she would see me. She'd, Mr. Dennis, come here. She'd give me a big hug, and, aww, you know, we would talk. So if you go into that branch, floor to ceiling is bulletproof glass. They literally work in a fishbowl. So there's this little tiny slot that you're supposed to put your deposit in. So she was back there, and some drug addict guy that had misspellings on his little note showed up and slid the note underneath this. And she looked at him, and her trauma response made her went, oh, hell no. No, you didn't. And she got out from behind the glass, walked around, slapped him upside the head, and said, you sit your little narrow butt down. You wait for the policeman. And he goes, yes, ma'am. So I showed
up. How does that happen?
It was her trauma response, right? So I show up, and I was looking very much like my culture, that I was very much Italianized. I was wearing a black suit with a black tie. And it was just what I was. I looked more like a hitman than a therapist. Right. I show up while the news vans are there, the police are out, the whole nine yards. And I just casually walk up to the front door and they let me in. And everybody's like, you know, who the hell is this guy? Right. So I get in there and there's Mama. She's standing there and she looks like, she says, give me a hug. And I, this big, just huge, just awesome hug. And I said, okay, you got to talk to me. And she goes, I don't know. It just popped in my head. So wait a minute. Who did this person remind you of? She goes, it reminded me of my nephew, Quincy. And that boy's always doing some stupid stuff. And I went, don't ever do that again. Right. So
did he have a gun?
That's what happened. This guy didn't know what hit him after she was done with him. It was just amazing. But that was trauma response. So we had to talk about just not doing that again. So I leave. Reporters flash up to me and they start saying, you know, well, can we have your name? And I'm like, I don't know. And then they said, well, what happened in there? I don't know. I can't give away confidential information. And sure. So they were like, can you give us the scene completely? And I was like, I don't know. So I get to the parking lot or the parking garage. It's right near it. I get in there. My mom calls me on the phone, right? And I was like, hey, Mom. And she goes, oh, my God, for somebody with all your degrees and licenses, you really don't know anything, do you? And I said, oh, you saw me on TV.
That's so funny.
So it's again, we're a jack of all trades sometimes. You're there for the person for whatever their needs may be.
It sounds like it, but you're also putting your life at risk in some of these situations.
Yeah, sometimes. Not all the time. I hope so. I hope not, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, because you said the tsunami. I mean, that couldn't have been...
That wasn't fun.
Pretty.
No. That was... That one to date, the last big international one was in Haiti that I went to. And the problem was that they can't insure us the way that they used to. So it has become exceedingly risky for us to go to places to do the work that we do.
And you just go on a moment's notice if something happens?
Pretty much. You know, like I said, not as recent, but yeah, you know, it used to be, you know, you'd get the phone call and you'd go. Now, you know, it depends on what occurs. You know, I could be like all of my patients at the practice sign a waiver basically saying like, look, I could leave mid-session based on the need or what have you.
Gotcha.
Keeps us on our toes.
What was that? Keeps you on the toes, on your toes?
All times.
Yes, it sounds like it. There's never a dull moment. So on top of the foundation, you also have... a side project with beer, wine, tequila. I mean, I want to hear about that and how that works into the foundation. I assume that you have events with your brand.
Oh yeah, we do. We do some really fun. We, you know, over the years cultivated great partnerships with people, you know, not to promote, but I will. You know, we have a couple that are coming up. We actually have La Fiesta, which is at the 23rd Street Armory, which is a 3-day event where we're the charity of the event. The Trauma Survivors is the charity of the event. We have the next weekend after that, we have the beer-a-thon that's down at the Navy Yard, where you get to run a mile, drink a beer, run a mile, drink a beer, run a mile, drink a beer. And
that sounds fun.
You know, we have the Philly Wine Fest, which is at the zoo, at the Philadelphia Zoo, which I don't know why people like drinking in front of animals, but apparently people do. You know, God bless. Okay. And then we have the Wilmington Street Food Festival the same weekend. And I have a book signing that same weekend as well over at the winery we're partners with. So, yeah, we do a ton of events. We actually, one of my own little pet project event is the Delaware Beer Fest. We're actually having that on October 5th at the Blue Rock Stadium. So we were partners. The charity partners with the All-Star Craft Beer and Wine Festivals at Citizens Bank Park and PNC Park down at Texas Stadium, and just awesome events. So this year we're going to keep the baseball park theme and take over the Blue Rock Stadium down in Delaware. And then one of my other ones that I absolutely adore is our Black Tie and Sneakers Gala, and we're going to be bringing that back to Philadelphia as well, which I, you know, everybody gets dressed up and you have the great sneaks on, you know, the women are in these beautiful gowns and they have these, you know, blinged out, if bling is still a word, I don't know, whatever.
It is.
And, tennis shoes and so on. So we do all that, you know, for the events. For me personally, I am partners in a brewery here in Delaware, Bellefonte Brewery. But we're also charity partners with Big Oyster Brewery, which is down in Lewis, Delaware, that created our Survivors IPA, which we didn't know it was going to happen. We brought out the label 36 hours before the total shutdown in the pandemic.
Oh wow, what timing.
We had worked so hard for this, and then all of a sudden, boom, it happened. But as everybody knows, in the pandemic, a lot of people drank during the pandemic. So we did very well with that beer when it came out. And then friends of mine, Heather and Dan, out of Wagon House Winery, said, hey, would you like to do some charity partnership with a wine? And our first wine that we started was the Captain's Punch. And I will give an aside to Wagon House. If anybody, any of your listeners, are Italian red wine drinkers, the bold Italian red wines.
I love them.
I'm
not Italian though, but I love bold red wines, especially Italian.
Nobody's perfect, Jen. Nobody's perfect. No,
exactly. That's true.
But I owe you two. I owe you the Captain.
Thank you.
And they're Sangiovese. I think Dan Sangiovese red holds up to any Napa Valley and any Italian red that's out there. It is that good of a wine. So when we partnered with Wagon House, I was over the moon excited because I knew how good the product was. So that was that. We also partnered with Knob Creek Bourbon. We had our Hospital Heroes Bourbon that all the proceeds went to our Hospital Heroes food drive that we started in the pandemic, where right now we are at 150,000 meals that we delivered to 126 locations. We raised nearly $1 million on that project. And some of it was funded by bourbon, you know.
Hey, why not?
And then on the foundation side, we're also coming out with a national brand tequila that hopefully will be out by the fall. You know, the trips to Mexico have been kind of fun and interesting, but sure. You know, I caught a little flack for it when we first started this with, you know, how dare you with a trauma survivor foundation work with alcohol? And look, you know, I tell people even biblically, you know, if alcohol is used appropriately, it's for celebration and fun. And with the amount of tragedy and stuff that we see and the trauma that we see, we have to do something with it. We have to be able to have fun with it as well. And so, you know, we got into that and had fun. We also, you know, to counteract that, I have an online coffee company. So, you know, if you want to sober up, you could go over to survivorsbeveragecompany.com and buy some coffee. You know,
I don't know how one person has this much time. I'm amazed. I love coffee. I love wine. So both up my alley. I'll definitely check them out. Where is your gala, the sneaker? And is it, what is it called? Black Tie and Sneaker Gala?
And Sneakers Gala. It's been 8 years. Last year we did it at Live Casino, but we're looking at a different venue, hopefully in Center City. Kind of has a crystal in there somewhere. Oh, okay. I'm not going to say where it is yet.
Done many events there.
Yeah, but we're looking at a couple of venues with it, and hopefully we'll make an announcement very soon. So it's fun. It's one of those ones where you just have this really great time and, you know, you just have this cool little celebration. Everybody looks good. It was funny. When I bought these, the URLs, the domain names for some of these, you know, and somebody with the Delaware Beer Fest, it was a bet. Somebody told me that you couldn't have a successful beer festival in the state of Delaware. And I'm like, all right. So I went in to get the domain, and it cost me $2 for the Delaware Beer Fest and Delaware Beer Festival. And I thought,
you got them.
Well, but I thought, so nobody's tried this before, right? You know, so we've developed this really great beer festival. So same way with Black Tie and Sneakers Gala, I thought there is no way, you know, that it has to be taken. I ended up buying the domain for $2 for Black Tie and Sneakers Gala. And started that. And it's funny, since then, I've seen a couple of look-alike galas and balls with black tie and sneakers. And I thought, maybe somebody's poaching an idea from somebody. Don't know who.
The flattery, or what is it? Copying is the
best form.
Form of flattery. Yeah. So you have to look at it like that. I know, because I've been to some. I don't remember what charity now, but it wasn't yours, because I would remember if I've been to one of yours. So I agree.
You don't ever forget one of ours. It is that much fun. We have people, and it's funny. I do a blog for the Delaware Beer Fest, and I wrote about, how fun Delaware Beer Fest is, but it turned into a singles meeting place where we've had 100 couples come out of the Delaware Beer Fest. We've had 42 marriages, 22 little beer fest babies, and I officiated 5 weddings that everybody met at the Delaware Beer Fest. So if you're not having fun at one of our events, there's something wrong with you. It's not what's wrong with us.
Right. If you need PR, I'm sure you have some, but if not, I would love to do PR on that story, especially around Valentine's Day. When is it? October?
October 5th. So that could be another Valentine's Day. I don't care. Yes. I'm thinking Beer-tine's
Day. Yeah. I want to go. I used to do the PR for All-Star Craft Beer and Wine Festival at Citizens Bank Park, at least the first couple of years that they were doing it, and definitely the first year. It's a great event. It would get packed. So I'm glad that they're doing it in other cities.
Yep, we did it. So it's funny. It's the when we had it down at Texas Stadium. So we were down at Ranger Stadium 2 years ago. And we're taking that side of things, taking a break this year. And that's why we're bringing it to the Blue Rock Stadium this year. But when we did it down at Texas Stadium, I was standing in the middle of Texas Stadium. And I don't measure myself on monetary success. I don't measure myself on how many people know me or whatever it is. What I measure my success on is based on the individual that I help. If somebody could come in and basically, what was it? Ralph Waldo Emerson said, if one life breathed easier, you're a success, right? So my thought was, if one person feels good about being them because I helped them in some way, then I'm successful in life, right? So I'm standing in the middle of Ranger Stadium in Texas, Now, conversely, I was down in Houston for the Hurricane Harvey relief efforts. So we're here in Dallas, Texas, Eagles enemy zone type of thing. And I'm looking up and there's that logo. There's that Trauma Survivors logo. And it said, proudly partnering with and sponsoring or proud charity partner and sponsored the Trauma Survivors. I had just seen that at Citizens Bank. I saw that at PNC Bank Park. I saw it out in Minnesota at the Twins Park. And I'm looking there and I just got this crazy emotion. I like literally getting choked up right now thinking of that moment where I'm looking up and I'm like, wow, man, this is it. This is cool. So I did that. I didn't know there was a family there that came specifically out to the Arlington area, Arlington, Texas. And if you know Houston and Arlington, they are about 4-hour difference. It's a long drive. And they came out specifically because they saw that we were the charity of it in the hope that they would see me again. I had helped them get reunited with their family that was completely flooded out during Hurricane Harvey and had worked with them pretty intensively during my time down there. So I'm kind of moving around the stadium, shaking hands and, all that great stuff. And then I turn around and I see this family and done. I'm crying, they're crying. We're just in this really great, great, beautiful moment. And to me, that's what I do it for. I do it because I know these folks are going to be okay someday. Like they can go through the worst point of their lives, but they're going to be okay. So if it's through a festival, if it's through a tequila, if it's through counseling, we're going to make people feel okay.
Yeah, that's a very rewarding moment for you in a time where you can like really appreciate it because you're so busy. So I think more people need to do more positive feedback for themselves when they do successful things like you've been doing for years now. But I love moments like that. So, and I'm sure people who've had them in their lives can feel that emotion as well.
Sure.
I want to talk about a few more things. So I want to talk about your books. You have many. You have at least, from what I count, 4 complete, 1 coming, I believe.
Yep,
so can we talk about them and you know, the one that I know we can talk about all of them, but I know that there's one specifically you'd like to promote now.
So one, my hardback book, my real book is called Beyond the Call. It's a guide for first responders on resilience. Basically, it's the ability the book was made so that the first responder could have the ability to read this book and understand that mental health should be a part of their life just as much as going to the gym. You know, you should look at your mental health as much as you do your physical health. And so I wrote this book with that in mind of helping them preserve, you know, out of their times of crisis and out of all the things that they've seen, you know, that this book was there to give them a guide, to make sure they know where they were going and how they were going. I mean, some parts of the books are very personal to me. Other parts of the books were just basically like instruction, like how do you find a therapist and who do you go to? And is it a vetted therapist? And, you know, you might be reading this book in California and don't know where to start. So I even give practical knowledge of where to go, you know. And so that was that book. That came right after I had done another ebook about the guide for well-being for first responders. And then my second ebook to that was one that I started on my own self, and then I figured I'd share it with everybody. And I know it's a podcast, so we could be a little loose, but the one's called Own Your Bullshit. And it was basically about taking a long, hard look in the mirror and seeing what was wrong with you, you know? And I tell folks, like, look, I'm one person, and I have the same amount of problems that anybody else has had. You know, there's times in my careers where, you know, you just kind of look at yourself and say, you know, where is the direction I'm going and where do I need to go? And so I did a 30-day plan in this book and Own Your Bullshit about truthfully looking at yourself in that mirror and saying, okay, it's go time. Like, how am I going to get to the best version of myself? And if I do this, if I do these next 30 days by following that plan, you know, at the end of the 30 days, I'm going to be right on track to be the best version of myself. And I think all of us have to take that long, hard look. I know I have. My other two that are coming out, we have one that the working title right now is Tragedy to Triumph, which is going to be for healthcare workers. And then one that I think is the most difficult one that I have been working on. I have a podcast and I have a blog series on it, but it's aptly titled On Being a Trauma Therapist. And it truthfully is about me and about, you know, what the life of a trauma therapist really is about versus what people think it's about.
What is it? Could you kind of wrap it up in like a brief sentence on what it's like being a trauma therapist? Yeah, I know. I have so many questions, but I don't want to like get off track because there's so many things I want to talk to you about. But I am curious, like how would you describe that to people?
It's like having a bag of weasels being carried by a bag of monkeys in your head at all times. No. I wrote it in the sense of like, look, you know, we're wired differently. You know, and God bless, you know, I meet with a group that I've been meeting with for since my master's degree and, you know, since all my schooling and so forth. I meet a group and they are mainline therapists. They're all in like Ardmore, Berwyn, Gladwin, and all that. And that's where their practices have gone. And all of them see patients in that area. And I always say, you know, you see such vanilla patients. And
they're 100%. Like, I went to Villanova, so I would know that better than anyone.
And it was like, you know, somebody would come in, oh, I got stress on the job. And we have a monthly meeting where all of us talk with each other. And we go around this group. There's 14 of us. And we go around this group and they'll sit there and say, well, you know, I worked with this CEO of a Fortune 100 company, and he's decided to recommit himself to his wife after his 100th affair. And I'm going, oh, God. Yeah. And the other one would say, well, you know, I just spoke with Miss Krabappel, and she brought her poodle in for dog training because it kept going to the bathroom on the Persian rug, and she was very anxious. And then they're like, well, what did you do yesterday? And I said, oh, you know, I responded to a bridge collapse in Baltimore and was talking to the workers that couldn't speak English, but, you know, I had an interpreter. And they look and go, So
can I compare?
Yeah, we're just wired differently. And so the book kind of, I started, you know, the outline of the book basically saying that is that there's not many of me in the world. There are trauma-informed therapists, which a trauma-informed therapist is somebody that understands that everybody has trauma and affects you in the world somehow. That's trauma-informed. A true trauma therapist, psychiatrist, psychologist, we're the ones deep in the trenches, and we're the ones that are on scenes. We're the ones working with, you know, the police, fire, the survivors, and, you know, so forth. So the way we look at things is different. It's funny. One of my patients earlier today, a police officer, had said, do you diagnose people? And I said, within the first 30 seconds that I meet them.
Seriously?
That's kind of scary. And he goes, well, what did you diagnose me? And I ran down his diagnosis, and he sits back and he goes, oh my God. And I was like, what, wrong? And he goes, no, right. And I said, look, man, I'm not the sharpest tack in the box. I'll be honest with you. I said, but when I'm seeing literally in my career, hundreds of thousands of people, you have to pick up people pretty quickly, and you have to size them up based on their need. And I love being a diagnostician, but it also helps me because then I know what their need is very quickly. And he's like, well, that makes sense. And I said, you got to think about it. Anybody in any career that if they're good at their career, sizes people up pretty quickly. Mine, we just diagnose people pretty quickly. It's fun at a party, you know.
Right. Oh my gosh. I would be asking a million questions on that. That's a whole other podcast. So are you kind of numb inside? I'm only asking that because when I was a TV reporter years ago, if I saw like a dead body shot up on the street or like someone dead in a car accident, like, and the victim's families came to the scene, I would have to shove a microphone in their face. And I did it. And I didn't really think twice because it was my job. But then sometimes I was like, maybe this will affect me down the line. I don't think it did, but, you know, it sounds cold. That's why I was just asking.
I'll diagnose after the podcast. No, okay. Numb is it. I think it's all based in relativity, right? You know, it's I know what the job is, so I put the game face on, and I know what it is. I'm a big sensitive guy. You know, the reality is that, you know, I cry watching Bluey, for God's sakes. You know, it's I literally so. I was telling the story to another patient. I get into those YouTube spirals every now and then. And I did it the other day. It was just a stupid, sad country song. And I got into the spiral of these country songs. And I'm literally on the floor in a puddle, just like crying. I'm like,
I've been there. I know country songs can get you.
Oh, so no, I think it's, you know, like you're saying, it's like you know, you're on the field and you're right there trying to go over this. And I view it as I don't want to be part of the problem. So my emotionality has to be set aside. That does not mean, you know, that afterwards that I think about it. Like I said earlier with Sandy Hook and also in any shooting that dealt with kids, you know, it takes its toll.
I can't imagine.
I would say the Pulse nightclub, when we went down to Orlando, I was down there for about a month, and I actually was working with a reporter. They were, oh my God, what they saw and what they experienced was heart-wrenching. And so one of the reporters down there, I am still in touch with her. She's a wonderful person. Her brother was shot, and her brother came over from Cuba probably about 5 years prior to that. And when he came over based on persecution. He a gay individual, you know, he was getting just ruthlessly picked on. So when he came over, you know, he found a community in Orlando. So he was shot twice. He was in the hospital. The reporter came to me and said, look, my mother just came from Cuba to be with him. But they haven't spoken in like 6 years since he left because the mother did not agree with his lifestyle. And so I said, look, you know, if we're going to go talk to him, I will be there. You will be there and mom will be there. But we're going to make it happen. And so I went into it's a David Young hospital system down there. And we went in there and I started speaking to him. It just a really, you know, he's in this worst way, but he was trying to accommodate me by saying, oh, you know, I don't look okay. And I'm like, man, don't even worry about that. I said, you know, your sister wanted me to talk to you. and, you know, make sure you're okay. And I said, but I'm only going to talk to you if you allow me to bring one person in. And he, you know, who's that? And I said, well, let me bring her in. I brought his mother in. So he starts crying. His mother starts crying. The reporter starts crying. I had to step out into the hallway. I had some dust in my eyes. It was a little dusty in that hospital, but it was that moment where, you know, I couldn't contain whatever feeling I had inside. It was this wild moment where that was the first time I truthfully cried in front of any patient or anybody that was helping me, just because of that situation. So it's being human in all this, right? So am I numb? Maybe, you know, I think I have, like, I don't know.
It makes sense when you say you have to take the emotion out of it, because I had to as a reporter, obviously, but then later I'd be like, God, I'm so heartless, shoving a microphone in their face. But on some warmer things, talk about what you're doing with dogs and how you're training them to help at various, I believe you said, police headquarters or facility dogs.
Yep. So we have a program that we're rolling out. We have our first trauma and wellness facility dog, Deputy Commander Barry, down at the Wilmington Police Department. Barry is a big old black lab with this big old big head and big paws, and he's great. There is a person we work with down in Texas. She trains the dogs. These are all rescues. So these are not, you know, bred for this or anything like that. These are all rescues that she trains for a couple of weeks, and then we'll hand them to us, and then we bring them over to the facility. So Barry is our first one. He's with my partner in crime, Lieutenant Bozeman with Wilmington PD. He works with their wellness. If you go to Wilmington PD's Instagram or social media, Barry has his own Instagram site. He is this great, great dog. But the cool part about Barry is that he'll go to our debriefing. So a police officer shot, or if there's, you know, any death or any critical incident, Barry goes with us, and Barry will go in and out. And he's trained to sniff out the stress pheromones in the folks that are the most stressed out in that situation. So it's pretty wild to watch Barry's work. He's still a work in progress. He's a fun guy. But that's what she does. Our hopes is to get 150 of the rescue dogs. That's our goal, to get 150 of the rescue dogs to different facilities, specifically police, fire, and EMTs.
I love that. Well, keep us posted on that. We'll have to check out your website. Hopefully you can put up the dogs' pictures. Yeah. I've seen some police stations, I believe, post their training dogs. They'll have like a training picture day. It's so cute. Maybe you could do something like that.
We want this to grow, and I think we found the right partner. She's great. But you're right. I think it'd be fun to get all the dogs out there. Because right now, you know, a lot of police departments, when you think of canines in a police department, you think of like the drug dogs and the bomb dogs. And you don't think about them having this facility dog that'll go out to bad events, you know. And so I think the more that we do it, you know, you're going to see that normalization. You know, people are going to want these dogs, and
yes,
we're going to see them, you know.
They're much simpler than us. That's why they just look at the environment. They're not staring at their phones. So I'm jealous of their lives sometimes. I was reading in your podcast survey that you like do gratitude tips each day. Is that something you do each day? And is that something you recommend people do? What do you recommend? Because everyone has, you know, their own stuff going on. How do you help them? Like, I listen to a lot of podcasts. So I listen to like Dr. Joe Dispenza. And I think it's so fascinating how people can change. I'm a work in progress because I don't do it enough. But you're supposed to, you know, your thoughts can become things, and you can train your mind basically to think anything you want. And it has like health benefits, all kinds of things. So anyway, talk about like what you do or how you help people get in that space.
So my personal habits, and you know, this is just why. Actually, it's funny. I have it here. I have my notebooks. If anybody could actually decipher my handwriting, I'll give them $100. But what I do is every morning I write down 5 goals. Now this is something I learned when I think I was 19 or 20 years old, from Dr. Pat Kranz, the coolest psychology professor ever. She gave us this task of writing down five daily goals. And then she gave us like these 3x5 cards, little notebook cards. She said, write five goals on the front and then write how you completed them on the back. And this was for like a behavioral psychology class. I was playing sports. I was in a fraternity. I was in, you know, all this stuff. And at 19, you don't take it seriously. So I started writing down these goals and it was like, go to the gym, hang out with the dudes, chase a girl, you know, whatever. It was just like, And so we walked in for the next class and Pat was holding her trash can. She goes, go ahead, throw it all in there. And I was like, I did it. Didn't I get the A here? And she was like, no, you guys did a to-do list. You didn't do a goal list. And I was like, okay, well, talk to me. And she says, mm-hmm. A goal list has to be done within that 24 hours and you have to feel successful at the end of the day for doing that goal. And so I was like, okay, we'll talk more. And she goes, the goals have to be about personal, you know, something personal that you want to do, something professional you want to do. A pay it forward goal, a spiritual goal, something that's going to make you feel successful. And it clicked. It clicked at that moment that, wow, I could do this. And so I started doing my five goals a day. And then I kind of got, you know, a little bit more into it. So I started doing five gratitudes. And those gratitudes are, what am I thankful for my life in that day? And then it was like, well, you know, let me step this up a little bit more and then write down five positive words, you know, or 10 positive words, excuse me. And what they do is that if you start this every single day, and I try to teach people this, is that if you start on a positive note where you are setting yourself up for success since the second you wake up, you have no other recourse but to try to be successful that day. You know, you have to think about it. You're set up in the morning to just, I got to get up, I got to go to work, I have to talk to this weird shrink on my podcast, I have to da da da, you know, and I have to do this, you know, you're not thinking about it. But if you slow it down, take that 10 minutes every morning and write down, like my goals are, you know, and I'll share them. It's not, these aren't like super secret ones, but I said, you know, my goals this morning, prepare for the podcast interview. It was pretty simple. So preparing myself was like, you know, trying to watch the colorful sentence enhancers and all that and telling myself not to cuss like a sailor and, you know, pay it forward by buying somebody, someone a coffee. I did that this morning. I bought people behind me. I stop at the same Dunkin' every morning or the same Starbucks. I trade off depending on if I want bitter coffee or weak coffee. And then I pay for the people behind me in line. What is it, $20? And the reality is it makes them feel really good and it makes me feel really good. And then I said, prepare for my conference meeting. We have we're rolling out a trauma and wellness concert, a 10-city conference that we'll be doing starting this September. So I had to prepare for that. I said, what was it? Oh, God. Yeah. I said, reach out to one friend. I have a friend that made some suggestive posts on Facebook that might be going through a hard time with one of his daughters. So I'm going to call him today. And that was one. And then I said, reach out to my niece and her wife. They just had their first baby. So Karina and Julia. So reaching out to them. And the reality is that if I finish all of these, which I will, I have that feeling of success at the end of the night. So at the end of the night, I write down what I did to accomplish those goals. So if that makes sense,
I love it. I know. I was listening to one this morning. It was the Mindset podcast, I think. I don't even know the guy's name because I just started listening to it from others, but I believe it was this morning, or maybe it was Dr. Joe Dispenza. It doesn't matter. It was like the one word can change, like one negative word can change like your day.
It could change your entire outlook. Like the words I wrote down, you know, kind, persistent, tenacity, caring, understanding, motivated, hopeful, friendly, confident, and flexible. You know, if I look at those words and I am to use those words today, even when I'm talking to people about using those words, the idea is that I have changed the mindset to make it more effective. Look, there's no joke here. We're not going to get out of this world alive. Somebody had asked me, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, it was like, how how long do you want to live? And I said, truthfully, I would love to live forever because I want to see what happens next. You know, and I said, I would love to do that. I said, but I'm not. I want to hit maybe 90, 95, be a healthy 90, 95. I said, but the reality is that in between the time from now till then, there is so much in this life that you have to experience. And so if you wake up every day just with this terrible attitude about what happens in that day, then you're not going to get anything accomplished, you know, and you think about it. It's taking those calculated risks every single day to say, I am going to make a difference in myself and I'm going to make a difference to the people around me. And maybe that, you know, you think about it, Jenna, is that, you know, when we set this up, when we set up the podcast, it truthfully, and I'm not saying this to, you know, give you a big thing, but this brought me a lot of happiness. This was like, I'm looking forward to this. This is great. And so preparing for it got me excited, got me ready for the podcast. And anything that I do that way shows me that, look, there is more things out there than we've actually truly experienced. So why not experience them?
I love that. That's a great way to end this interview. I just want, and I'm sure so many people want to know, where can they find you on social media? And I don't know if you promote both, like yourself and the foundation. I assume you promote both because of your books.
We kind of have to, right? Well, you can normally find me at Starbucks up in Concord near the Wegmans.
I'll be there tomorrow.
So pretty simple. Let's start with the foundation first. Go to thetraumasurvivorsfoundation.org. You'll notice this big donate sign. We have tons of stuff up there. Go to my personal website, denniskerradin.com. It's Dennis, DennisCarradin.com. In there, you're going to find links to the books. You're going to find links to the podcast. You're going to find links to blogs. You're going to find links to our events too. You can go to DelawareBeerFest.com. You can go to SurvivorsBeverageCompany.com. You could BlackTieAndSneakersGala.com. There's a lot there, but you know, I'm on social media. I always, you know, and anytime that I do an interview, whether it's in a podcast or the news or whatever it is, I tell people, like, look, all of my stuff that I put out on social media is positive. And it's because that's how I try to live my life. So when you go and you go through my stuff, that it's real. It's stuff that I want to impart to people. I wrote a story, you know, just about a chance encounter with somebody at a Wegmans, you know, where I didn't recognize the person. I didn't know who it was, but they had read one of my blogs and, you know, recognized me from the website and came over to me. And he's like, man, you know, I was going through a divorce. My kids hate me. And he goes, and I read that blog about owning your bullshit. I was like, okay. And he's like, I turned it around. He goes, I'm real happy right now. I'm in a good spot. And he goes, I really want to thank you. And then I was like, okay, what's the angle? How much money do you want from me? You know, type of thing. And then he goes, do you mind if I pray with you? And I again, emotional like hell. It was like, wow, that's cool. So again, if you follow me, I love you to follow me. I will always answer you back. But yeah, go to traumasurvivorsfoundation.org or denniskerradin.com. Do what you got to do.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll have to do a part two.
There you go.
Tell me, because I did like in your questions to my podcast about chance encounters and how like relationships, like random relationships, build more relationships and experiences. So we'll have to talk about that.
I will tell one real quick, this one. So to me, you could be top CEO, NFL player, or the janitor. You're all the same. You know, it's truthfully to me, people are people. I love people, whatever it is. I don't care how much money you make. I don't care what size house you're in. People are people. So I was asked to go to a concert and was actually backstage at a country concert. And I struck up a conversation with this guy, which I thought was a guy, you know, a guy from like Tennessee. So I he ended up being the headline country artist that I was talking about life and fishing and friendship and, you know, all this great stuff. And the DJ, who was a friend of mine, had said, I have to pull so-and-so away from you. And I went, wait a minute, that's so-and-so? And they're like, yeah. And this is like a huge country artist. Well, we forged a friendship since then, and we've been very good friends since that chance encounter. So my daughter is a Penn Stater. My oldest daughter is a Penn Stater, and so he was doing his world tour and stopped up at Penn State. So he calls and he's like, "Denny, I got you 20 VIP passes and all this." And I was like, "Cool." I was like, "I'll pass them over to Melina." And he says, "Great, give them to Melina. She's having this great time. Got backstage hanging out with everybody." Well, one of her friends calls me and is just, crying, thanking me profusely. And I couldn't figure out why. I was like, "Look, it's a concert. It's cool. I talked to this guy about fishing, whatever." So Melina later confided in me that this was her dad's favorite country artist. And again, I'm not saying names, you can figure out,
Right.
It was his favorite country artist. And it was the last concert that the two of them went to before he died of cancer.
Wow.
And
meant to be.
It was so yeah, we could have
need a part two.
Huge talk about those. They're fun. Those chance encounters are amazing.
They are. I know I've had a few myself. I have to think of them, but they are the best because you never know who someone may know or who someone is, like in your case.
Hence why you always have to be that. You always have to be kind and humble. As long as you're kind and humble, dude, you're gonna go places,
100%.
We'll go places,
Thank you so much, Dennis. This was so much fun.
Absolutely. And I now have my PR connection. So we.
Oh, yes. I'm going to do all your PR. Now. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jen.
I'll talk to you soon.
Bye now.
Well, that's it for now. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Please reach out to me so I can feature you on my show. I do respond to everyone. You can find me on my Instagram at Jennifer Sherlock or my business Instagram at JennaCom. And check out our new website coming soon, livewithoutanet.com. Thanks again, and I look forward to taking risks with you.